Welcome to a Show Me Institute podcast featuring interviews and discussion about economics and public policy.
This is John Payne here with Tom Woods, author of numerous books. How many books are you up to now?
This is 11.
That is kind of amazing. And also, just in case anyone questions your academic bona fides, you hold a PhD from Columbia. Okay,
yeah.
And your undergrad is from Harvard.
That's right.
Okay. So your latest book is called Rollback, which would it be fair to say is sort of a sequel to Meltdown?
Well, it's broader in scope. Meltdown was focused on the financial crisis, with then some other stuff about money and banking and whatever. But Rollback is focused on everything. Like you name it, we got to get rid of it, and it's both stupid and immoral, pretty much. I mean, and it does have a chapter on the financial crisis, but this is sort of stuff I've learned since I wrote Meltdown, so it's not like the same old stuff, because I've read an awful lot more about deregulation and some of the specifics, and I'm trying to answer the question, was it deregulation that caused the meltdown? But beyond that, I mean, there's a Fed chapter, there's a military-industrial complex, there's the chapter on, oh gosh, what would we do without this or this or this? We'd all be dead if it weren't for our wise overlords, that sort of stuff. That's all in there. So the idea is that it's helpful both for a libertarian who is just, who has to deal with all these objections all the time. But secondly, it's useful for your uncle who's in the Tea Party, because it's got Obama on the cover. He doesn't like Obama. But this book gives him so much more than he bargained for. But it draws him in with that kind of initial gut appeal.
Right. So how are we doing at rolling back the state right now?
Well, you can answer that question yourself by looking around, but yeah, not so well. But what I'm kind of arguing is that, it's possible that we could have some successes, but that one way or another, it's going to have to be rolled back, because inevitably, we all know the entitlement programs are hopeless, and we get told, well, don't worry about the debt-to-GDP ratio. It's been this high in the past. Yeah, it's been this high, like, during World War II. But then eventually World War II comes to an end, whereas this doesn't seem like it's going to come to an end at all. So there's a lot of ugliness that's coming in the future. So if we don't do something, the something will be done to us. Like, we will emerge with fewer government promises being made to us, that's for sure.
Hard choices will have to be made one
yes.
way or the other.
And you notice it's all in the passive voice, decisions will have to be made. That, no one wants to talk about who's going to make them, what kinds of effects they're going to have, but all of us are going to suffer one way or another because of these jerks.
Yeah, and I'm inclined to think since it's all in the passive voice, that means that it's not actually going to be anyone making the decisions, it's just going to be, well...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they themselves have nice, comfortable pensions. They will all be retired in a nice tropical clime somewhere, and you and I will be picking up the pieces, yeah.
Yeah, it'll just sort of collapse at some point. But, well, so, I want to talk about Meltdown for a second. I know you wrote that, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Okay. So Meltdown was basically about how the financial crisis of 2007, 2008 happened, correct?
Yes, right.
All right. And so, can you give a brief synopsis of your take on that?
Yeah, sure. And I just realized that Meltdown, Nullification, and Rollback, they spell out Murray N. Rothbard's initials. So it's like I'm trying to send code to people, except I'm not really sending code because I come right out and say you should read. I dedicated Meltdown to Murray Rothbard and to Ron Paul, actually. But basically, yeah, the quick version is that the standard kind of conventional wisdom that was already beginning to ossify when I wrote this was that, deregulation caused this, and, so now we need the Fed and the federal government to fix it. And, and it's not to say that, no private actors bear any blame. I mean, like, nobody's, I'm not trying to caricature the free market position, but I'm suggesting that the deregulation that did occur is not relevant to what happened. I mean, yes, deregulation occurred, and yes, we had the crisis, but nothing they actually did, I think, could bring about this crisis. None of these specific things could bring it about. So the way I turn the tables, I always say, point out to me the repealed regulation that would have prevented this crisis, and they usually can't. So then it boils down to, well, it's because they weren't proactive enough. I say, oh, okay, well, that's different. But even then, who's going to be proactive? Who? The Federal Reserve Chairman? They were all telling us that lending standards were robust and all this stuff, and you should take out an adjustable rate mortgage. These people? Who? We already had...
Where are you going to get these regulators with perfect knowledge
exactly,
and foresight?
Exactly. And we already had... I have a chapter on this in Rollback. But, you know, we had 115 separate agencies to regulate and oversee the financial sector. So you're telling me we would have been better off if only we'd had 116? Then so I'm just not buying this. And so I'm arguing that it was indeed... I mean, sometimes the mainstream right wing is correct about something, and there was this political manipulation of the mortgage market, but then fueled by the Federal Reserve, and they've been desperately trying to point fingers at everybody else. But I'm arguing that there is a traditional Austrian business cycle at work here, and that, you know, everybody sort of, this has become one of these things everybody thinks he knows. Like, everybody thinks he knows that FDR got us out of the Depression and all these other, and now it's, you know, well, if you leave people to their own devices, they cause financial crises. And I'm just, piece by piece, I'm trying to put together a different narrative of these events.
Right. So let me ask you this. It's now 2 years later since you wrote the book, and we still seem to be in something of a recession. There's not as many jobs coming back. So what is, to put you on the spot a little bit, what's your prognostication for the future, given our current policies?
Well, I mean, it's not impossible that the Fed, by continuing in its policies, that it could, you know, again, create an artificial stream of jobs. And that's the issue. I mean, Hayek really put it well when he said in the 70s that the kind of stimulus that inflation of the money supply brings is stimulus that's caused by the errors it produces, because the money that's created, this is all just, it's all phony, it's all just summoned out of nothing, and it goes into streams and lines of production that wouldn't have been generated otherwise. So it's things that can't really persist unless we keep the phony baloney money going, and then you have to keep it going at an ever faster pace to get the same fix, and it just gets worse and worse. So, yeah, you might get the appearance of prosperity, but again, that's going to have to be reversed at some point. I think what's more likely is that we'll probably have a kind of a stagnation for a while. I mean, the most disturbing poll I saw, well, I guess there are a lot of disturbing polls, but last year they did a poll of college seniors. 85% of them say they're moving back in with their parents after college because they don't know what in the world to do. So I think that probably that's what we're in for, is the stagnation and then just gradual worsening. But the crisis that could hit us, it could happen that things just get gradually worse and we just sink gradually down. But it could also come very suddenly, because there could just be one or two negative headlines coming out of the U.S. about the economy or the political class or whatever. And lenders to the U.S. may say at that point, we'll keep lending, but not at these interest rates. And then the real funding crisis comes very quickly, and either they tax the population to the point of wrecking the economy, or they print the money. There is no other alternative. There is no supply-side alternative of growing our way out of this problem. Not this problem.
Or, they could cut spending.
They could, and I notice I don't even list that.
Yeah.
I mean, but that is what they will really, ultimately, they'll have no choice.
Yeah.
And especially when it's a choice between unplugging my grandmother or abolishing the Department of Energy, I think most people can make the correct decision there.
Yeah, right. And you know, even as libertarians, we don't like it to be to be forced upon us in that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. I mean, we don't. People have been put in the situation they're in. They've come to rely on the government, and you know that's not our fault. But we understand they're in that unfortunate situation. And of course, it would be nice to make this transition as easy as possible. And part of that's one of the things about skipping ahead to Rollback that I'm happy about, that there is the chapter about the real truth about the military-industrial complex, because I feel like I'm doing penance for my younger years when I bought into all the wars and I bought into all the propaganda, and I thought if you wanted to cut back the military budget, you were some kind of commie. Well, I'm making good on that. You know, like I'm turning things around, you know, because I did buy into that, and I understand why people buy into that. But that's obviously the first place to start. There's so much room to cut there. It is unbelievable. And we can't even audit the Department of Defense. It's incredible. They're exempt from audit.
So just to move ahead to Rollback real
sure.
quick, and then we'll go on to nullification. So what is your plan for how we can roll back the government and get back on a saner fiscal path?
Well, I mean, I've got a couple of sort of policy wonk suggestions, but that's so not my style, you know. But I mean, like George Reisman has this interesting plan where he says when you turn 65, you ought to be given a choice where you can either get the benefits or you can forswear the benefits, and in exchange for that, be forever exempted from all income, estate, and gift taxes. Now, you still have to pay payroll taxes. You'd still be paying into the system, basically. But you would be... I mean, I would take that deal, no, because I'm going to keep working till I drop dead. So that's an interesting thing. Of course, now, Ron Paul, I've heard just little hints in articles that I've read that if he were to run for president again, he's toying with the idea of saying to younger people, now that was a plan for older people, but saying to younger people, what if we offered you this deal? That, have you heard about this? We're opting out of the, you opt out of the system, you get nothing. Well, you get all the benefits of our military defense, which causes more trouble than gain, but you pay 10% taxes. You get nothing, but we ask nothing more of you. I think there are a lot of people who would take that, which is precisely why they'll try to smear him, ignore him, get him off the stage. So that type of thing, I think there would be a visceral response of, you know what, among some young people, we are getting so screwed. And these programs, they're expecting us to carry the whole burden of these things. When we can't even find a job, like, this just sucks, man.
Well, I mean, I'm already getting hit with more taxes than that, and
yeah.
I don't expect that I'll be...
Yeah, you're not going to receive anything, yeah. So you might as well take this opt-out. So then between that and then as the concluding chapter goes on, it gets more and more provocative. I mean, like, I'm talking about agorism, and, you know, like, just try to, the best you can, if you can find some way to get around the state and ignore it and just carry on your life... you know, maybe the best approach is not the direct confrontation approach that I sort of take in nullification, but maybe the other approach is just try to defeat it by starving it of legitimacy and revenue, and just death by a million cuts. A million little cuts might be the best way. Whatever suits your temperament, embrace. But all of us working together, like we'll find something to conquer this thing with. You know, I have to believe that.
Yeah, well, that's it's nice to have a little bit of optimism.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But so, a different solution you proposed is nullification, which you wrote a whole book about, and it's sort of an idea that has fallen out of favor in the last, basically since the Civil War.
Yeah.
But you're attempting to rehabilitate it. And can you explain, you know, a lot of people associate it with slavery and racism.
Yeah, yeah, and I understand that. It's not totally stupid to say that. Yeah, okay, so basically the idea is... that the states ought to have the power to refuse to allow the enforcement of an unconstitutional federal law. And it derives from Thomas Jefferson, but it goes, I show in the book, it goes back even further than that, it goes back to the Virginia Ratifying Convention, but Jefferson is the one who used the word nullification, and he said that basically just the very structure, as I said at the talk the other day, the very structure of the system demands it, that if the state, the peoples of the states are the original political units, and they create the federal government, then as the creators, even if they establish a Supreme Court, you know, you can talk all about that, but the point is that in the last resort, as Madison said in his report of 1800, you know, the courts can also screw us. So the creators have to have some way to step in and say, now, wait a minute, all of you have screwed us over, and we as the creators have to step in and say, no, you can't do this. No, we never intended you to have this power. Now, in terms of the misuse of this principle in the past. Well, look, I mean, basically almost any principle can be screwed with, except the non-aggression principle. I can't think of actually a way you could screw that up. But there are a lot of good principles that can be misapplied. But when it comes to nullification, it was never used to defend slavery. I mean, just from the common sense point of view, since there were no anti-slavery federal laws for the South to have to nullify, why would they have ever used it for that purpose? And that, to the contrary, the northern states, but especially Wisconsin, used it to fight against the fugitive slave laws, which they thought some aspects of them were unconstitutional. And so what I'm suggesting is, well, everything else has been tried. What's the worst that could happen with this? This also fails. Okay, well, at least we gave it a shot, and we got people thinking in healthy ways, that maybe this one city dictating to 309 million people and none of us having any way to dissent from it is not the only way we can organize society. That is a good way, and getting people to think outside the Joe Biden to Mitt Romney box that we're all trapped in, that is a healthy thing in and of itself. And so, you know, might as well give it a shot. And of course, it has had some, you know, some minor victories, you know, with the Real ID Act and the medical marijuana. And so Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center is trying to really bring this idea all over the country through the Nullify Now tour to see if, you know, maybe we can, you know, again, this is not the silver bullet. Doesn't solve all problems. It might not solve very many problems at all. We don't know till we try it. But we can at least maybe chip away a little bit. And it so enrages the mainstream media and the mainstream political class that, I mean, to me, I just have fun doing that. I mean, apart from the success we have with it, that's just great. Especially when you know you're right, that all the arguments they're going to throw at you are just inane and can easily be answered. In fact, I even did I have a page that I have a redirect, statenullification.com, where I basically went through all the questions and answers, all the objections, so that people could easily get a resource on it.
So let me throw one of the big objections at you right now. You know, a lot of people say, well, states can't do that because of the supremacy clause that says that, you know, the federal government is going to be supreme.
Right.
I mean, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, that's one of the ones I answer at that statenullification.com. In fact, I even answer in the book Nullification. Chapter 1 is just sort of setting the groundwork. But in Chapter 1, I say, now, by the way, before I even get into this, let me address this supremacy clause right away so that if this is the only chapter of this book you read, I at least get to that. But basically, I mean, the quick answer to it basically is that you have to read the whole clause. And the whole clause says that this Constitution and laws in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land. Well, if you read the 19th century debates about nullification, every supporter of it emphasizes this point and says that strictly speaking, for the purpose of this argument, we don't need to dispute the supremacy clause. We'll take that as a given. But our argument is that what if you have a law that is not in pursuance thereof, that is not constitutional? The supremacy clause does not say this Constitution plus laws in pursuance thereof plus any old law we might want to impose on you should be the supreme law of the land. No one would have ratified a document like that. We're saying that this issue, whatever it is, health care, whatever, is so egregiously unconstitutional that we don't even get to the point where the supremacy clause would apply. We're not even at that point. We're not dealing with a constitutional law. So the states have to play the role of stopping it or alerting their fellow states to the problem.
So now, you know, most people consider that think that the federal judiciary is the, you know, the be-all, end-all of constitutional interpretation. And obviously you think that, you know, the states have a role to play there.
Yeah, above them, yeah.
And now, you know, I've heard you criticize and read you criticize the federal judiciary for striking down a variety of laws or striking down a lot of state laws.
Yeah.
Now, what role do you think that the founders had for the federal judiciary? Because, you know, granted, they didn't have judicial review until John Marshall. So what do you think it was meant to do?
Well, I think, I mean, some people who support nullification are trying to position it as an alternative to judicial review. I think somebody like Madison kind of imagined both things working side by side. I mean, and I think the consensus among the framers was that they kind of took for granted there would be some form of judicial review. Jefferson was in kind of a minority because he believed in concurrent review, that all three branches had an equal responsibility before the Constitution. And there's, I mean, that seems to make sense too. But Jefferson sort of envisioned the courts as being more advisory bodies than anything else. But So, but what it seems like, if you look at Madison's view on this, he seems to be saying that in the ordinary course of American affairs, this is the setup, that we have this federal court system and it adjudicates disputes. But he seems to be saying that when you get to really dangerous exercises of power, where we're dealing with matters of high sovereignty that really touch on the whole nature of the structure and the whole nature of the powers of the states, that in that case, then that's where, you know, some kind of state-level defense comes in. Because that's when you have to say that in such a case, even the guard, like, who will guard the guardians, basically? Who will, you know, who will protect us against the guardians themselves? That's when, in these emergency cases, then you have some recourse to the states. So he sees them as working all together, basically.
So basically, it's just one more level of checks and balances.
One more level, exactly. Yeah, when there is a dangerous infraction, like they both use the word dangerous. Now, that's not to say you couldn't use nullification for a more minor thing, but they kept emphasizing a danger. Because if it's something that's minor, maybe you can deal with it through more conventional means. But if it's a real danger, then you've got to say, no, we can't let this thing become part of our regular practice. Because, you know, once the federal government gets accustomed to doing something, then it's very hard to reverse it. So this is a way of saying, no, we can't even let them get started. We can't even wait the 2 years for the appeal to get through the court. We have to just say, no, it won't be done.
So you think that the reason that it's never specifically mentioned in the Constitution might be that they didn't want it to be a regular part of existence that was just for reserved for, you know, extremely dangerous times.
Well, what we can at least say is that in the Virginia ratifying convention, which is arguably the most important one, they needed Virginia to ratify, and you've got all these important statesmen coming out of Virginia. There, they were told that it was already implicit in the document as written. That's what defenders of the Constitution said. Kevin Gutzman is the great pioneer in this area. And he says that that's where the Patrick Henrys of the world, who were skeptics, were assured that any attempt by the federal government to exercise a power not delegated to it, well, if they attempt to do that, Virginia will be exonerated because we are entering a limited government situation and we're subject only to the delegated powers. Any additional power, it doesn't apply to us. So that's, they were told, even before there was a Tenth Amendment, they were told this is what the Constitution is that you're ratifying. So given that that's what they were told, you know, well, then there's no need to, you know, okay, well, that's what it means. That's what this document means. So it's already there, basically.
Right. Well, I think that about does it for my, you know, scholarly questions. But so you recently moved to Topeka. How are you enjoying that?
Well, it's, you know, I'm close to Missouri. That's yeah. Same, right? So that's important. But, yeah, I mean, it's better for our kids, basically. It's more kid-friendly. We've got a nice school for them that I don't have to deprogram them. And I'm able to, thank heavens, I'm able to do my work from pretty much anywhere. And, you know, now I'm starting to do YouTubes and things like that from my own home. So I'm pretty happy. And I got TomWoods.com that as I have more and more time, I'm trying to post more on there. And so I have the kind of position that, like, 10 years ago, I would have so envied myself. But now I am that guy. I can't believe my good fortune that I basically just get to, you know, be my own boss, and, like, I get to be, like, a professional libertarian. Like, it's not even fair. Like, how did this happen? But I'm having a heck of a time doing it.
I understand the feelings.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I'm not quite at the level of you, as you are, but...
We're both doing this stuff, and it's great.
It is great. But sometime you'll have to come over to Missouri and speak to us over there.
I would be thrilled. They're trying to get a Nullify Now event in Kansas City, and there's a lot of pressure for that, so I suspect that'll happen. To have a speaking event that I could just drive to, I can only dream of such a thing.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
But, all right. Well,
okay.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.